On Wednesday, we all witnessed an attempted coup. Our democracy was assaulted by a crazed mob. As we start a new series through the book of Exodus, I know that the question can be asked, what does Exodus have to do with us now? How does this apply to us? How can this book written thousands of years ago in the Middle East speak to our turbulent times? Our passage today actually holds more relevance after the Capitol assault than you would think, than I even thought until one particular commentary helped me see. We will see that Pharaoh and his evil tactics against the Israelites are alive and well today and form the bedrock of what happened in Washington on Wednesday. Please turn with me to Exodus chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1, and we're going to read the first 14 verses. Exodus chapter 1, starting in verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. Each came with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The total number of Jacob's descendants was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Joseph and his brothers and all that generation eventually died. But the Israelites were fruitful, increased rapidly, multiplied, and became extremely numerous, so that the land was filled with them. A new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and powerful than we are. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them. Otherwise, they will multiply further, and when war breaks out, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So the Egyptians assigned taskmasters over the Israelites to oppress them with forced labor. They built Pithom and Ramses as supply cities for Pharaoh. But the more they oppressed them, the more they multiplied and spread so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. They worked the Israelites ruthlessly and made their lives bitter with difficult labor in brick and mortar and all kinds of field work. They ruthlessly imposed all this work on them. So the book of Exodus picks up where Genesis ended. I would recommend that anyone, when you have a chance, to read through Genesis to familiarize yourself with the background. So Exodus follows the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as they go from being guests in Egypt to being slaves, then to being free men and women journeying to the promised land. Scholars place the time period of Exodus at either the 13th or the 15th century BC. So Exodus starts by recapping the end of Genesis. The first five verses talk about the sons of Israel came down to Egypt with their father Jacob, Jacob being Abraham's grandson. Jacob was also named Israel. He was given the name Israel after he had a wrestling match with God. The two names are interchangeable. Now, there was a severe famine in the land of Canaan where Jacob was living. And Joseph, the brother who was sold into slavery, ended up in Egypt. And while there, through God's providence, he becomes the prime minister of Egypt. And through him being the prime minister, he's able to welcome his family into Egypt. So what eventually grows into the 12 tribes of Israel started with the 12 sons of Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, and Joseph. The number of Jacob's direct descendants who traveled with him to Egypt numbered 70. Now, this doesn't include the wives, the in-laws, and it doesn't include Joseph because he was already in Egypt with his own family. Verse 6, the Israelites live in peace and safety among the Egyptians. Joseph and his brothers eventually die, and their children continue to live in Egypt. Verse 7, the Israelites rapidly multiply. Now, we're not talking about normal conception, birth. We're talking about low mortality, infant mortality, and high fertility rates. They spread rapidly. This is a fulfillment of what God told Abraham. When God was talking to Abraham and was covenanting with him and was founding what became the nation of Israel, what became Judaism, God says to him in Genesis 22, verse 17, I will indeed bless you and make your offspring as numerous as the stars of the sky and the sand on the seashore. Now, if you're familiar with the book of Genesis, this is a very interesting reversal with what we have in Exodus. In Genesis, most of the women were barren. They were not able to conceive. And it took divine intervention from God for them to conceive. But now in Exodus, it's the exact opposite. The women are abundantly fertile. God's promise is being fulfilled. Now, verse 8 is where we have the shift, where there's an ominous change. Moses writes that a new king, or Pharaoh, as they were called in Egypt, comes to power. This Pharaoh did not know about Joseph. Now, when it says this Pharaoh didn't know about Joseph, this can be understood in two ways. First, this new Pharaoh very well may not have been familiar with the history of Joseph, especially if this Pharaoh is from a different dynasty and different ethnic group that is ruling over Egypt. Many different ethnic groups came into Egypt and gained power and ruled, and then their kingdoms fell and other ones rose. So there's a possibility that this is another Pharaoh from a different dynasty, from a different ethnic group that had no knowledge of Joseph and the loving relationship that the Israelites and the Egyptians had. But there's also another way of understanding this. This Pharaoh may very well have known about the history of Joseph, but chose to ignore it. So in saying that Pharaoh did not know Joseph, it may be an idiom similar to if one person is used to be friends with another person and they say, I don't know you. Of course they know them, but by saying, I don't know you, it's saying our relationship is cut off. I'm ignoring all that I knew before. The person that I once knew is now dead to me. So this may be what Moses is trying to tell us, that this Pharaoh rose up, knew full well of the relationship between the Israelites and his own people, and yet chose to disregard it. Verses 9 and 10. Fearful of the growing Israelite numbers, Pharaoh announces that something has to be done. The Israelites have grown in numbers and power. His statement of them being more numerous than the Egyptians is an exaggeration to stoke fear and xenophobia. Xenophobia, defined by Merriam-Webster's dictionary, means the fear and hatred of strangers or foreigners or anything that is strange or foreign. It's interesting, when there's a couple of foreigners, most people are okay, but when their numbers start to grow significantly, that is when the hatred comes out. This was best illustrated to me in a very shocking situation when I was in Serbia as a short-term missionary. Serbia, formerly Yugoslavia, is Eastern European, overwhelmingly white. I was probably the only black person for about maybe even 100 miles. And the people there were welcoming, were loving. My team, which was made up of people from the United States and Canada, they loved us. But something that I found really interesting, I was out one night with some of them there were college age people that I was hanging out with, and we were talking, we're hanging out, and a Chinese person walked by. And after the person was out of earshot, they started complaining to me about how the Chinese had come, and one person said it was like an infestation of them. And that just struck me. You're talking to me, I'm a Black American in your country. You're okay with me, but because there's several more Chinese people that have come to set up businesses and live life, it's a problem. See, it's interesting, you know, a few is interesting, but when we get too many, then the problems arise. So Douglas Stewart, his commentary on Exodus really helped me see how this applies to us today. He says about this passage, to portray his people is somehow a minority, potentially dominated by an Israelite majority, was a clever way to engender popular support for his plan. Stewart continues, all oppressive regimes use the threat of some great danger, real or imagined, to justify violations of human rights. Pharaoh was simply following this well-attested course of action. Pharaoh goes on to sell his plan. If they don't do something and do something soon, the Israelites are going to grow larger than the Egyptians. If Egypt is ever attacked by a foreign army, the Israelites will join them and overtake the country. Now, I know our translation, as well as other English translations, say that they will leave the country. But as I was reading some of the commentaries, they've said that it can also be translated overtake the country, which in this context makes sense. Why would the Egyptians be afraid of the Israelites leaving? So Pharaoh now has his people riled up. The Israelites are growing too strong or too powerful. So what he's saying is, they aren't Egyptians, they're foreigners living among us. They can't be trusted. If war breaks out, they'll fight against us. Notice the similar stereotypes about immigrants in America. The Israelites have lived in peace with the Egyptians for generations, but now they're being scapegoated as untrustworthy, crafty, and dangerous. Again, Douglas Stewart, he says, if a regime wishes to be given freedom to oppress a given group within a nation, it defines the group as a real danger and potentially the agent of overthrow of the established order. Pharaoh was spouting ethnic hate propaganda of the sort which still widely employed today, which is used to justify ethnic persecution and genocide. Right now in China, the minority group, the Uyghur people, are being sent to concentration and labor camps because they are a supposed threat to the Chinese government. For the past few years, thousands upon thousands of Myanmar's Rohingya minority group have been murdered, tortured, and brutalized because the government sees them as a threat. When you label a person or a group a threat, all civility goes out the window and brutality takes its place, as we see in Exodus. Verse 11, Pharaoh's plan is to control the Israelites' population through enslaving them and forcing them into hard labor. They are forced to build two cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now, again, Douglas Stewart lays out how this enslavement works as population control with 3 points. First, this enslavement, this forced labor, would separate families. Husbands and wives would not be able to be together. Families would be separated, which would keep children from being conceived. Second, food would be scarce for the Israelites. Think about it. They have to grow their own food. They have to tend their own cattle. How are they going to do that if they're forced to build cities? So any type of agriculture or herding would have to be done after backbreaking work. And third, the most insidious point of all, the hard labor would kill off the weak, the sick, and the elderly through malnourishment, mistreatment, and backbreaking work. Speaking on the third point, Douglas Stewart said, the severity of the workload was integral to population control. If people are going to die under a workload, it has to be hard enough to kill people, making sick and weak those who were previously strong, and ending the lives of those who were already sick and or weak. The Hebrews were put through a slow and agonizing plan of genocide, where they would literally be worked to death. Now, verse 12, God's funny. God's got strange ways. He's similar to Shakespeare in that he likes irony. He likes poetic justice. So even as the Israelites are being oppressed, even as they're being made to work, even as they're being strained, as pregnant women are being forced to build a city, they continue to grow. More babies are born. They continue to spread throughout Egypt. Instead of killing them off as planned, the hard labor has no effect on their capacity to have children. They continue to grow in numbers. And so the final two verses here, 13 and 14, the Egyptians aren't ready to try a new tactic just yet. So they increase the labor. They make the Israelites do more work than they were doing before. They are treated worse than work animals. But again, in the midst of all this, they continue to grow. And with this growth, the Egyptians continue to be fearful. So what does this have to do with us today and everything that happened on Wednesday? Pharaoh doesn't rally the Egyptians against the Israelites to enslave them for greed and profit, as was the case in American slavery. No, Pharaoh wants to kill them off, or at least severely bring down their population through hard labor. When we look at Exodus from that angle, it becomes extremely applicable to our time. Let's look at the situation. Let's step back. The Israelites have been living at peace with the Egyptians for generations. It was Joseph, the Hebrew, the Israelite, who helped Egypt navigate a severe global famine and save the country. Without him, Egypt would have been decimated. In thanks for his work, Joseph's family was welcomed into Egypt with open arms. But a new pharaoh arises, and he doesn't really care for foreigners that much. He fears their numbers. He fears their potential power. He sees them as a security threat to the Egyptian way of life. Since these men and women worship a different god and have strange customs, how do we know that they will be loyal if we are attacked? We've seen this rhetoric throughout history. The Nazis scapegoated the Jews and tried to exterminate them. Japanese Americans were put in internment camps when we entered World War II because their loyalties were questioned. After 9/11, every Muslim was suspected of being a terrorist and viewed as not truly being American. Let us not forget President Trump's famous words when campaigning in 2015 that follow in Pharaoh's footsteps when he says, when Mexico sends its people, they are not sending their best. They're sending people who have a lot of problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. This is fear politics. This is saying, be afraid of this criminal horde of Mexican and Latin American immigrants. It's dehumanizing. And it's not only dehumanizing, it's a lie. Crime studies statistically over and over again, time and time again, say that between native-born Americans, legal immigrants, and undocumented immigrants, native-born Americans commit more crimes, period, followed then by legal immigrants, and then at the very bottom, undocumented immigrants. In fact, in some cases, you're three times more likely to be victimized by a native-born American than an undocumented immigrant. Sadly, this truth doesn't sell as well as fear politics. Fear politics hits the right emotional points. And this is how we got family separation at the border, where children were ripped from the arms of their parents. If these immigrants are seen as a threat, then as I said, all civility goes out the window. The spirit and rhetoric of Pharaoh lives on all around us, and it boils down to demonizing the other, demonizing those who are different from us or our particular group, those who have a different skin tone, different hair texture, different religion, different education level, different political stance. The other is demonized as a threat. They're seen as outsiders, someone who can and will destroy our way of life. Once the other has been thoroughly vilified, they're free to be oppressed. That's what Pharaoh did to the Israelites. That's what Hitler did to the Jews. That's what Mao and Stalin did to anyone that opposed them. What we saw at the Capitol on Wednesday was the rhetoric of Pharaoh played out. The mob was revved up and ready to attack those they believed had stolen the election and posed a threat to their way of life. As time has passed, it's become clear that many in there had deadly intent. Weapons, bombs, plastic zip tie restraints have been found on numerous people who were involved in that insurrection. They were out for blood. President Trump and his allies stoked a fire that blazed out of control and turned deadly. During the rally, which took place before everything happened at the Capitol, really, Rudy Giuliani said the now infamous line, "Let's have trial by combat." President Trump said the following at the rally before the assault, and I quote, "But this year, using the pretext of the China virus and the scam of mail-in ballots, Democrats attempted the most brazen and outrageous election theft. There's nothing been done like this. It's a pure theft of American history. Everyone knows it." See, now we have an enemy, the Democrats who stole the election, and something has to be done. He continues toward the end of his speech. He says, "And now the caravan," speaking of Latin American immigrants, "the caravans, they think Biden's getting in. The caravans are forming again. They want to come up again and rip off our country. Can't let it happen." So here, fear is stoked that if Biden is allowed to be president, caravans of Hispanic immigrants will come in and rip off our country. Pharaoh's rhetoric, "We have an enemy who will destroy our way of life if we don't act now." So how should we as Christians respond to what happened? What is our duty in situations like this? First, we must denounce the violence that assaulted the Capitol and the violent rhetoric that fueled it. Whether it's a political party, a racial group, an immigrant group, a profession, or whatever, we have to hit back against the demonization of other people. What China is doing to the Uyghurs and Myanmar is doing to the Rohingya can happen here if we let it. But let's be honest, it's already happened here with the near extinction of the Native Americans. If we don't stand up and speak, bad things happen. If everyone is made in the image of God, which they are, we need to act like it and defend our neighbors. We need to take to heart what God told the children of Israel, what he instructed them after they were freed from Egyptian bondage. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, he tells them pointedly, you also are to love the resident alien. You are to love the foreigner, since you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. God is telling them to remember the prejudice, the hardship, and the evil that they endured in Egypt, and to never do the same to any foreigners who come to live among them. This is our charge as well, to love those different from ourselves, no matter how different they are. Put another way, we are to love all our neighbors as we love ourselves. We must love and never demonize, because we're all made in the image of God, and we must stand up against those that demonize and oppress others. In conclusion, history does repeat itself. Pharaoh and his racist and xenophobic propaganda continues on with us today. We live in a divided country during troubling times, and the weapons we must wield are truth and love. We must speak the truth against the lies and the propaganda, and we must show love to the oppressed and to the oppressor. We must show love to the terrorized as well as the terrorist. Our challenge is to live like Christ and be the voice of love, grace, and truth in this dark and divided world. Our job is to counter the lies of any modern-day pharaohs who seek to divide, demonize, and sow seeds of hatred. We may disagree with our neighbor, but we are to love them because they're made in the image of God. I close with the words of Christ in Matthew 5. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, 'Love your neighbor, but hate your enemy.' But I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward will you have? Don't even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what are you doing out of the ordinary? Don't even the Gentiles do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." Even if you look differently from me, speak differently, vote differently, I love you. That is the attitude that we must carry. We must refuse to divide and demonize those who disagree with us. Because if we don't, things are going to continue to get worse. Please join me in prayer. God, I know what we saw on Wednesday was troubling. We're still processing it. After over 350,000 people have died in our country from the coronavirus, we saw something that hasn't happened, they said, since the War of 1812. There's so much to process, so many thoughts, so many feelings, so much emotion. Lord, help us to rise above fear politics. Help us to rise above knee-jerk reactions. Help us to rise above the rhetoric of pharaohs on either side of the political spectrum. It doesn't matter if it's Republican, Democrat, Green Party, Libertarian, whatever. God, you made us all in your image. You love us. Help us to love others as you have loved us. Because that is the only thing that can turn the tide in our country. You can't fight hate with hate. It doesn't work. Lord, give us the love that we need as a congregation, as individuals, as Americans, to help change this country in a way that we can disagree without it turning into violence, where we can work together, where different political parties can seek the greater good of this country and the world. It's a miracle that only you can do, Lord, but it's one that I know that you're willing to do. Christ's name I pray. Amen.